Well, we've got a problem. Most people in our city do not believe that following Jesus brings life, love, and freedom. In fact, most people in our city think that it leads to the very opposite, that is guilt, judgment, and constraint. And there's no clearer place where people point to apart from on the issue of sexuality. The sexual orthodoxy of our culture teaches that the Bible's view on sex is anti-life, anti-love, and anti-freedom. A couple of weeks ago, I was listening to a podcast by John Mark Comer, who is living in Portland, Oregon, and is just a very, very insightful cultural analyst. Makes very interesting cultural things, and he reminded me just how much change we've experienced over the last 50, 60, 70 years in the West. In just over half a century, you know, we've seen the internet rise, we've seen the rise of email, the smartphone, AI, transport, travel, gay marriage, civil rights, terrorism, globalism, the mapping of the human genome. And no wonder there's so much social unrest and anxiety, so much change, perhaps the most change any generation in the history of the world has experienced in one or two generations. And he goes on to describe, and he's picking up on some other writers, the five tectonic shifts in the way that we think about and express and process sexuality in the West. In just one or two generations, we see these five major changes. And the first is this, that sex has been disconnected from family. It's so easy to forget that birth control as we know it dates back to the 1960s, when the American FDA approved the first oral contraceptive pill, and in 1961, it was accepted into Australia, only for married women, right? When it first came in, if you're a single person, you couldn't go on it, and later that changed. So your grandparents, it was illegal for people without a husband or wife to take the oral contraceptive pill. And in the same decade, there was a ruling in the Victorian Supreme Court which made abortion legal, not just for physical safety of the mother reasons, but also for reasons of mental health in the mother, and that became adopted throughout Australia. For most of human history, it was not an option to experience sexuality without at least a risk of long-term responsibility for kids. And we've had this massive change. All sorts of effects on sexuality have been the result of this. And most importantly, it's made the primary purpose for sexuality of most people in and outside of marriage as being for pleasure rather than for procreation. Go back 100 years, procreation was very much to do with sex, but we've seen this change. Sex has been disconnected from family. That's the first change. A second change is this, that sex has been disconnected from marriage. It's no longer just two people in a relationship until death do us part, as it was in almost every single culture down throughout history and around the world, still for not just Christians, but all over the world, for the Dalai Lama, for Islamic culture, really throughout most of the world today, sex is, the proper context for it, is within marriage. But we've changed all that. We've separated sex from marriage. And again, the effects on sexuality is enormous. It's created all kinds of anxiety around sexuality because so many people today have soul ties to other people. And we're going to come to that in a bit. But without any long-term commitment of, I'm with you, no matter what happens, let's have sex. Now, that's changed. Thirdly, sex has been disconnected from male and female relationships. It's hard to imagine that same-sex marriage only passed in December, not last year, but the year before. It feels like it's been around for almost ever. Maybe that's because it's been in the works for so long. It's been disconnected from gender. The fourth one is this, that sex has been disconnected from love, emotional, and really any kind of relational commitment of any time. We've seen the rise of the hookup culture, the rise of Tinder, the kind of swipe, not sure which way you swipe, I've never done it, right? But whichever way you're swiping. And the ethos of this kind of culture is that, sex is for pleasure, it's for recreation. I don't need to be in a relationship with someone in order to play tennis, and I don't need to be in a relationship with someone in order to have sex. It's just a mere self-expression. And Donna Freitas, in her book, The End of Sex, has this, a great summary of the recent data on sex. She says that more and more people are delaying marriage to focus on their career. A career has become the new de facto god of our culture. It's the place where we find the meaning and purpose to our lives. And because career is the meaning of our life, then we don't have time for relationships. So during that hiatus from relationship, when we're just working on career, which lasts anywhere between 10 to 20 years, most people still want sex, but they don't want love, they don't want commitment, they don't want emotion, which is too time-consuming, messy, exclusive, requires too many limitations, and career is the thing they're pursuing. And so eventually, most people will want sex with commitment, but right now, most people don't have the time. Sex has been disconnected from relationships and love. And then fifthly, let's ignore that. So those four shifts, really it's nothing new. I mean, people have been sleeping around together outside of marriage forever. For a very long time, prostitution was an ancient rite, single bars are nothing new, gay relationships are all over Greek mythology, even gender fluidity has a long history. But what is new is that more and more people pitch these shifts as moral progress, as liberation. And you think of the language, the way our world talks about sex these days, it's talking about liberation from oppression of tradition and religion, of gender roles, gender itself. It's all pre-Freudian superstition. And we need to kind of get away from that. We're enlightened today. And anyone who holds to those ancient views of sexuality, they're at best behind or at worst requiring some moral and social and political rebuke and repair. That's where we find ourselves, which leads us to this last shift, which is really quite recent and really is the canary in the coal mine, that sex, we're beginning to feel in our city, sex has been disconnected from people. Cue the sex robots, right? Basically, it started in Japan with the rise of loner culture. If you know anything about that, the breakdown of family, divorce, social anxiety, and people are too scared of entering relationships, but have drives and sex drives, and we're seeing it rise in New Zealand, Australia, England, and America. And basically, what's happening these days is you can pick an anime character who you fall in love with, marry, then you buy a doll, a robot of this kind, and you can marry this robot. And new technology is coming on the radar where not only are you able to have sex with this robot, but with AI, you'll be able to have a virtual relationship with them as well. They'll be programmed to say and do what you tell them to say and do. One person who's into this is what they see. You're free from all the responsibilities of being you're free from all the responsibilities of being in an actual human relationship, and to enjoy some sort of acknowledgement from an entity that is not you in your own head. And we see that this is being picked up in movies. Who's seen this great Spike Jonze movie, Her, with Joaquin Phoenix, in which, you know, here he is, he's in the LA of the future, he's beautiful people in a beautiful city with great jobs, nice clothing, nice little moustache. Looks a lot like Jared Grice, actually, to be honest. Are you here, Jared? Sorry. They've got all the technology, and yet this whole culture of people in this movie, they're terrified of relationships. So Joaquin Phoenix's character falls in love with his equivalent of Siri, who has the voice of Scarlett Johansson. Right, there is a voice to fall in love with, right? But this is what is happening, and this is the shift. This is the really scary shift. It's picking up on the pain in our society around sexuality. For all the idealization, for all the supposed progress in our world, there is a staggering amount of pain, wounding, abuse, anger, violence, dysfunction, fear, regret from sex gone wrong. And so the question we ask today is, are we really living in a culture that is experiencing progressive sex? And is Christianity, as the world thinks, really regressive? One of the great places to look at this question in the Bible is the book of 1 Thessalonians, which the Apostle Paul wrote to a very young church in a city not unlike our own. Christians there are living very differently in three areas of life: sex, work, and death. Verses 3 to 8 of 1 Thessalonians 4 is about sex, then work, verse 9 to 12, and then chapter 4 he covers death. Sex, work, and death. Three areas where if you're a Christian, your lifestyle and attitudes will be absolutely different from the world around you. The Greeks and Romans, they were amazed at the Christians and their attitude towards death. They would go to their execution in the gladiatorial pits, singing hymns of praise to God. And it stunned the people in their culture. In the area of sex and money, the Christians were so different. We see this in an ancient letter, to Diognetus. It's one of the very earliest Christian writings that we have. It's a letter from a Christian, Mathetes, to his non-Christian mate, Diognetus. And in it, he basically says this: we Christians, we share our table, but not our bed with all. It's very interesting. You see, in the ancient world, people didn't share their tables. They didn't share their money. They held on to their money. Money was sacred. But sex, well, that was mundane. They'd share their bodies with whoever they wanted, but their table, their money, they wouldn't share it at all. But the Christians in that day, they were the opposite. They didn't believe money was sacred and sex was mundane. They thought sex was sacred. They guarded their sexuality in the context of marriage, but they didn't guard their money. They were liberal with their money. And so Mathetes says to Diognetus, our attitude is completely different. We share our table with all, but not our bed with all. And you know, the early Christians, as a result, their lives were marked by life and love and freedom. There was something stunning about the way they lived their lives. And although the Roman and Greeks in that world laughed at them for their attitudes towards sex, money, and death, their ethic swept through the Roman Empire. And people listened to it and watched it. And my great fear in our culture, as it laughs at Christians, my great fear is that us Christians will flinch and we will grow ashamed of what actually did see moral progress in the history of our world. Our society today thinks very modern, very liberated. It considers itself progressive on attitudes towards dying, money, and sex. But if you look closely, you realize that society's going back to the way the Roman Empire was on sex and money. We're sharing our bodies, but we are the least generous generation for many, many centuries. We're not giving to the poor like we used to. We're going back. We're not progressing, we're regressing. We're returning to attitudes towards sex that are ancient, not modern, predictable, not progressive. And so if you want to be progressive, learn from Jesus. Otherwise, you'll be squeezed into the mold of our culture and you'll fail to live with revolutionary impact as a true progressive. That's my introduction. All right. So what I want to do today is I want to look at whether Christianity is anti-life, anti-love, and anti-freedom. That's what our world says. I want to show you that is the opposite of what the Bible says, and it is the world's view of sex that is anti-love, anti-life, and anti-freedom. So the first one's this. Is the Christian sex ethic anti-life? This is by far the longest point I'll make, and the other two come quite quickly. The first thing we see in the Bible is that the Bible says sex is good. Come with me, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 3. And this is what it says. It is God's will that you should be sanctified. Some translations say holy. Two very religious words which we don't really know often what they mean. What does it mean to be sanctified or holy? Most people think it means to be a stiff, moral, religious person, or simply to be a perfect person, but that's not what it means. In the Old Testament, animals could be holy, pots and pans used in the temple could be holy, right? They weren't morally perfect. A pot, a pot doesn't say, you know what, haven't been sleeping around this week, haven't got drunk, I'm holy, right? So it's not. To be holy isn't to be morally perfect, because an inanimate object can't be morally perfect. So what does holiness or being sanctified mean? Well, it means to be holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, to be holy God's. It means to be set apart holy for God's use. The pots and pans, that's what they were set apart holy for God's use in the temple. And if you're a Christian, you've been called to be set apart holy, used for God's use. Took quite a long time before Liz and I started dating. And that was because I had other priorities, love surfing, and I was an accountant. And I made a cost-benefit analysis between, should I date, should I not? The costs were too high, so I held out for quite a while. I measured the cost of having a girlfriend against the amount of surfing I could do with the same time and money. And so as a result, I'm like, no girlfriends for me. But finally, when I started to date Liz, everything changed. I started to spend money on a mobile phone so that I could talk to her. I'd put money, petrol, in my car, not just to drive to the beach, but to drive to see her. And all of a sudden, I started ironing shirts, watching different kinds of movies, and researching restaurants. My life changed because I became wholly devoted to pursuing her and not just great waves. What does being holy mean? It'll end up meaning you're pure and perfect and moral, but it doesn't basically mean that. It means something much more basic. It means that you get rid of all distractions and you wholly focus on God. That's what a Christian is. You've stopped living for yourself and you've made God the focus of your life. And so when God says, I want you to be sanctified and holy, notice therefore what he says. It is God's will, verse 3, that you should be sanctified, holy, set apart for him, that you should avoid sexual immorality. So notice he doesn't say, I want you to abstain from sex. That's how you exercise being wholly devoted to me. No, he doesn't say that. He doesn't say you've got to avoid sex. He says you've got to avoid sexual immorality. And we'll come back to that word in a second. What God's telling us here is that sex improperly used will undermine your commitment to God, but sex properly used will enhance and strengthen your commitment to God. Now, that is crazy. Most people think that Christianity teaches sex is dirty, stay away from it, and just stay focused to God. That's not what Christianity says at all. The Bible criticizes that sex is dirty view by saying very positive things about sex. 2 years ago, we did a series of teaching on the book of Song of Songs, which is a book in the Bible entirely devoted to sexual love in marriage, where a man and a woman, they sing songs to one another as foreplay before sex. And here's how progressive it is. It's the woman and not the man who is the dominant voice throughout the songs. She's the one who seeks, pursues, and initiates. That's ancient progressive sex ethic. Let me just read to you one moment where during lovemaking, she sits there and looks at him from head to the middle region and sings about it. This is what she says, Song of Songs. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is purest gold. His eyes are like doves. His cheeks are like beds of spice. His lips are like lilies. His arms are rods of gold. We'd say biceps, you know, like big, you know, I don't know. And then she says, his body or member is like polished ivory decorated with sapphires. Now, pretty much all the commentators cannot bring themselves to tell you what his polished ivory body actually is. But one Old Testament scholar, Tremple Longman, he confirms what we suspect, that she is singing about his sexually aroused organ. In the Old Testament, there was a law in the book of Deuteronomy where you couldn't be drafted into the military or any other government service. And the reason was, if you'd just been newly married, and the reason was this, and I quote, for 1 year he is to be free to stay at home and bring happiness to the wife he's married. Now, that's your job, husbands, to bring your wife happiness. And it's not just talking about taking out the garbage, putting the toilet seat down and watching Netflix together. It's talking about making love to her. Here is the progressive view of sexuality in the Bible, which elevates female sexuality, which culture has always downplayed and dismissed for generations. The Bible's view of sex is good. It's not dirty. It's something God-given. Now we return, come back to Paul's statement about sex in 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 3. Let me read it to you again. It is God's will that you should be sanctified, set apart for him, focused on him, that you shouldn't avoid sex, but you should avoid sexual immorality. He doesn't say avoid sex. He says avoid sexual immorality. The Greek word is porneia, which is a catch-all term which refers to any form of sexual relationship outside of marriage. What that means is the Bible paints only two alternatives. Sex in marriage, or if you're having sex, you're misusing it, sexual immorality. The Bible says you should avoid sexual immorality, which means that sex is not for before marriage, it's not for outside of marriage, it's for and only for inside marriage. That's where the Bible says it works. Now, why is that? Why does the Bible say that? Well, because sex creates a soul tie, a soul union with another person. If you've got a Bible, come over to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, where the Apostle Paul is also speaking about this. And 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16, the Apostle Paul says, "Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body, for it is said the two will become one flesh." Now, this is very interesting. He's not talking about adultery per se. He's talking about two people who are having sex to just gratify an appetite. It's mutual, it's consensual, and it's simply seeking to gratify an appetite. He's wanting to gratify his appetite for sex. Her appetite is for money. And the Apostle Paul says it's wrong. And the reason he says it's wrong is because sex was designed to create one flesh. And he's not just talking about the way a man and a woman fit one another physiologically. He's convex, she's concave. When they come together, they experience physical oneness. No, no, when the Bible speaks about one flesh, it's speaking about something deeper than mere physical oneness. It's speaking about a oneness of body and life. Sex, according to the Bible, is unique body language. It's a way of saying to someone else, "I belong exclusively and completely to you and no one else. I'm not holding anything back from you. I'm not hiding anything. All of me I give to you." Sex is the God-given way of saying to someone, "I belong completely and exclusively to you in every aspect of my being, socially, economically, legally, emotionally, spiritually." That's God's purpose for sex. It's that it would form, express, and strengthen the deep union of a man and woman in lifelong marriage. And that's why there's no such thing as casual sex. You can't be casual in having sex, because sex is the way you say to someone, "I belong completely and exclusively to you." I mean, you listen to songs about sex on the radio, and the way we speak about sex is as this kind of extraordinary, cosmic, all of me giving myself all of... Secular people are saying that. We understand the body language of sex. And yet when our culture says, you know, sex is just an appetite, and so it's normal to give your body without giving yourself, you can give your body to have sex and hold on to your independence, hold on to your life, keep individual control. The Bible says when you do that, you're damaging yourself and you're damaging others. You're sinning against your own body. You're using your body to tell a lie. Your body is saying one thing, and yet your living situation, your bank account, your legal status, everything else is saying a different thing. You know, if you're having sex in the context of whole life commitment, the result is a deep soul nurture. If physical union is an expression of what you've done with the rest of your life, it deepens trust. You know, there's this old school writer, John White, and he says that, speaking about sex, he says, "When she caresses my body, she caresses not just my body, but my soul. And I feel completely accepted." See, sex within marriage, when used properly, it deepens trust. There is a man and a woman who have so committed to one another for life, and they look at the person, they say, "I love you and I accept you absolutely, fundamentally, completely, and I'm giving my life to bring you pleasure." It's an apparatus which strengthens trust. But if you use it outside of marriage, you're actually saying, "You know what, I want physical oneness, but I don't want whole life oneness. Let's give ourselves to one another physically, but let's not give ourselves to each other completely. I still want to make my own decisions. I want my money belonging to me. I still want to be independent. I want you. I want your body under me, but I don't really want you completely in my life. Do you notice when the Bible speaks about sex only in marriage, it's talking about sexual integrity. It's saying integrate your body with the rest of your life. If you've given your whole life to someone, your whole life, every aspect of it, then give your body with it. But if you haven't, don't. Do you see that? So if you look at the Christian attitude to sex, it is not anti-life.